Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would we do differently if we could know in advance when disaster was likely to strike? For most of human history, our ancestors looked to clairvoyants, dreamers, and signs from the heavens to foretell the future. But in the era of modern science, those notoriously unreliable forecast methods have been set aside in favor of high-tech equipment to detect minute but significant changes in the world and computer models, which can help predict the effect such destabilization might have on geology, finance, even political and social activity. And the more we learn, the better we may be able to prepare ourselves to emerge from crises unscathed, if not prevent some of them altogether. The new book by science writer Len Fisher explores these ideas. It's called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities: How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. Len, welcome to Think.
Oh, very nice to speak with you. That was a lovely summary.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you, by the way. What time is it where you are right now?
Oh, it's 3 a.m, but I'm an early morning bird. Although I'm in Australia, maybe not quite that early usually.
Well, we really appreciate you getting up before the worm this morning. So obviously, Len, in order to understand when bad things are about to happen, we need to understand why they happen. And it seems crises tend to occur when the balance of things gets out of alignment.
Oh, that's also a very nice summary. I mean, if you just look at the way you normally live your life, you always tend to be going slightly out of control. Maybe not you, certainly me. Things tend to get into a runaway situation, but we have all sorts of mechanisms to control them so that when we go slightly haywire, when the stock market goes slightly haywire, there are mechanisms to bring it back. That's called negative feedback, which is very different from the way that psychologists talk about it. It just means that the more something deviates from equilibrium, the more the system starts to push it back. And that's the way.
Len, are you with us?
Feedback.
The phone line seems to be cutting out. We're going to try and raise Len Fisher on a different phone line. Are you with us there? Okay. We're going to call Len Fisher back. He is a science writer. Apparently, that connection to Blackheath, Australia may not be exactly what we were hoping for. We will call back in just a moment. Our number, if you would like to join the conversation later in the hour, is, as always, 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Our guest is Len Fisher, author of Crashes, Crises, and Calamities. Len, do we have you back?
You absolutely have me back. I hope you don't lose me again.
We'll cross our fingers. So you were talking to us about negative feedback.
That's right, about the control thing. One of the ball cock in the toilet. What do you call toilet? I've lost the words in America.
The toilet.
That'll do?
Yeah.
The ball cock in your toilet works like that. Mm-hmm. Because the more the ball cock lowers, the harder it's pushing to try and get back. So the ball cock controls how much, it's not going to run away, but if the ball cock fails, the whole thing floods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the runaway effects that you can get. That's called, in science, positive feedback. So let's get rid of all those terms now. We've got the negative and the positive feedback. The whole point is that you've got some things happening in most systems tending to get a runaway effect and other things tending to control them. I think one of the simple examples is in an earthquake, where normally you've got pressures building up under the Earth's surface. But because the rock is basically elastic, it's pushing back, holding things down. Then it gets to a point where it can't hold it anymore, and you get this runaway explosion as the magma bursts through. So that's a very simple example of this balance. And these tipping points, these critical points, happen when the balance shifts in favor of positive feedback and the balance shifts in favor of runaway effects. I think even in relationships, and I've been trying to work this into my Psychology Today blog, when you have relationships going wrong, you're trying to keep it under control, and there gets to be a point where you just get this runaway explosion of anger or argument, and the relationship sort of breaks down, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, what's so fascinating about all this that you're writing about in this book, Len, is that it's not just geology or architecture or anything like that. It is also in the social world, in the financial world, where something that initially we might be able to bounce back from, once it reaches a certain critical magnitude, it just continues to snowball, as we've seen over the past couple of years.
I talk about things like the banking crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis, and so on. The main question, of course, is, do we get any clues as to how these are going to happen, when they're going to happen, and when they're coming?
Yeah, what does it take to recognize mounting positive feedback conditions, even when things appear unchanged overall? Perhaps there are those little compensations that don't show us any effect right away.
Well, it used to be, say, for example, on the stock market, there's a nice example, that trying to predict what the stock market was going to do, the general assumption was things in the future are going to be pretty much the same as things in the past. And that sort of prediction system just doesn't work, or everybody could do it. But if you watch stock markets, pretty much the same as when you watch relationships, just before a crash, what happens is that things start to wobble. And if you look very carefully, you'll see several signs which have now been identified, that you tend to get extreme conditions, like extreme optimism followed by extreme pessimism. Another thing that happens is that you get very rapid shifts between different states. The stock prices, for example, will tend to go up and down rather fast. And you also lose resilience. So if things change, if there's a little bit of worry in the stock market, instead of that worry just getting damped down, it starts to get amplified. So those three things, this increasing occurrence of extreme states, this hopping backwards and forwards very rapidly between different states, and this loss of resilience where it can't recover when things change slightly, those three symptoms have been identified as the three major symptoms of a coming crash, of things going wrong, of positive feedback taking over, and the whole thing running out of control. And that actually came, surprisingly, from ecology, where ecologists were trying to understand why you got sudden crashes mm-hmm. in ecosystems. And when they looked very carefully, and this is a man called Martin Scheffer in Holland, who did most of the early work, and he was interested in lakes because over that way they've got lots and lots of cool inland lakes as you get towards the north of America. And what he noticed was you'd get a beautiful clear lake and come back a couple of weeks later and suddenly it had gone all turbid. Or you get a very turbid lake and you think nothing could live in that. And he'd come back shortly later, and suddenly it had gone all clear. And he couldn't work out how this sudden flip from one state to another was happening, the same way as we get sudden flips from one state to another in the stock market, in relationships, and in a lot of natural disasters, come to think about it. And so trying to identify these sudden flips, Martin is, I have to say, a rather good computer programmer, mm-hmm. and he just put in all of the processes that could be happening. That's all the negative and positive feedback processes. Now, you can't get an intuitive feel for these things and how they balance out. It used to be the idea of the balance of nature, where everything sort of stays in equilibrium and just drifts along fairly slowly. But what Martin found when he looked at all these different processes tending to maintain stability, tending to produce runaway effects, that when you put the whole lot into a computer to balance out, you get very non-intuitive result, that things will be going along very smoothly, and then suddenly, just with a slight change of circumstances, there'd be a flip. The runaway process would take over and take you to a totally different state. And he saw that in ecology, and then he and others started to look at, well, other things in the world where you've got these complex situations, like complex societies, complex political systems. And he found the same sorts of things happening. that your things could be going along very smoothly, and suddenly you could get a jump into a totally different state. And then when he started to look more closely, this was when he started to find that just before this happens, these various warning signs show up. And it's not necessarily easy to identify them. I mean, if we could, we'd be in a wonderful state. If we got to identify them in the stock market, we could get the hell out before the thing crashed. If we could identify them in relationships, we might be able to do something about it. If we could identify them in international relationships,
yeah,
it would be absolutely wonderful. But this is just the first step. He's told us what we can look for. The next step is to start learning how we can look for them.
So talk about how the different kinds of variables go into a mathematical computer model. And you do have, and we'll talk about them, some caveats for us lay people, us non-scientists trying to understand these things. But you have to factor in what you know, and to a certain extent, you also have to factor in what might happen, and that's where things can get a little wonky.
Well, you have to factor in the effects of various processes. Say in an ecosystem, well, I'm just trying to think of a really nice, simple example. And let's talk about trees growing in the Sahara Desert. And I'm doing this one off the top of my head, mm-hmm. So it's going to be very interesting how it comes out.
We'll stay with you.
If you just have one tree growing somewhere in the Sahara is going to be exposed to the blazing sun, it is not going to last very long. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a couple of trees growing side by side, they're going to give each other a tiny bit of shade for some parts of the day.
Mm-hmm.
As you get a bigger and bigger, but they're still not going to be very happy in the long run. But if you get enough trees growing near each other, they can protect each other. Their root systems will protect each other. Their crowns will protect each other's root systems. And in fact, we know from experiment, just from looking at these things, that together they'll actually start creating their own little microclimate.
Hmm.
And when they do that, then that microclimate's very good for them to grow. So if you get a sufficient, this is the thing called the allele effect, which is ALLEE. If you get a sufficient number all close together, looking after each other, suddenly there comes a point where the thing can take off and where it can grow and where the trees actually take over from the desert. And we know that that happens. We also know that it happens in human societies. There's a not very nice word for it called a ghetto. But what you're really talking about is when you get a group of people with similar ideas close enough together to support each other, suddenly you get to a critical point where you have a stable community. If the group goes below that number, then the community can very, very rapidly fall apart.
Hmm.
So there's quite a critical point in communities, both of plants and of people, that lets you see the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, when you have, it's been proven that when you have groups of people who have similar ideas, they actually get stronger and more stalwart in their beliefs when they associate mostly with people who have similar beliefs.
That's absolutely right, and that can be either good or bad, of course.
Yeah.
Because that's where it gets complex, and where you have to start looking very, very carefully just what is going on. But the basic idea is there, that there's a particular critical point where you can get stability, and below that you can get runaway collapse.
Science writer Len Fisher is my guest. His new book is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities: How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Len Fisher. His new book is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities, How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. Len, I want to go back in history a minute to how we handled this before we had science, because people have always wished to know what was coming so that they could prepare for it. Of course, we used to assume that maybe there were people who could read the future. Most of us don't believe that now. But there have been, over the centuries, people with these anecdotal reports that animals seem to somehow know when a crisis is coming.
Oh, yes. And now this gets extremely interesting because I think they probably do. And the more you look at the evidence, the stronger the evidence becomes. These stories go right back to ancient Roman times. And there was a town called Helice, which, for those who know the Mediterranean, is near Corinth. Very ancient city, and the residents of Helice noticed one day that all of the animals were heading up the road towards Corinth, and all sorts of animals. It's a very powerful description of them. 2 days later, there was a tsunami, and Helice got drowned. In fact, it got drowned to the extent that the whole city was then totally on the bottom of the ocean. And Roman tourists used to come along and look down through the waters at it and marvel. But these stories have been going on through the centuries, but not until recently have any scientists actually been able to see what was going on. And you may remember there was a big earthquake in an Italian city of L'Aquila several years ago. Mm-hmm. And just by coincidence, there was, an ecologist up in the region, and she was studying something that seemed to be totally unrelated, which is the breeding habits of toads in a lake that was near L'Aquila. And this is just before the earthquake. And she was more than a little annoyed one day when she came along and found all her toads had vanished. and just a couple of days later, there was a huge earthquake that knocked down the medieval center of L'Aquila.
Hmm.
So that was the very first time that a scientist has been able to say, yes, I was there. Yes, all the toads vanished. Then there was the earthquake. And then they came back.
Hmm.
And there's quite a few things like this. What on earth can be going on? What can these animals be detecting? And in this particular case, other scientists had just happened to be measuring radio waves from the ionosphere and noticed a big change in those. Now, of course, if they happened to be a signal for an earthquake, then you wouldn't need the toads to detect them. Because if we can detect them, we can do something about it.
Sure, we just want to know.
The trouble is that whatever it was that the toads were detecting, Maybe the radio signals, who knows? It's not necessarily the same for all earthquakes, because prior to other earthquakes, you get things like radon being released from the ground, or maybe you've heard of, or the listeners will have heard of, these things called P and S waves.
Yeah.
That earthquakes give. A P wave is one that sort of is compressive, like when you shake a slinky, if you've got those, and you mm-hmm. see these waves. But the really damaging ones are the S waves, which are the ones that shake the Earth up and down. But P waves are faster than S waves, so they can act as a warning. But also, somebody's pointed out that P waves sometimes slow down just before an earthquake. So if we were making little miniature earthquakes, just with sticks of dynamite, and kept an eye on this, perhaps that would be a warning. But none of these signs are universal across earthquakes. So we really are still in a bit of a puzzle as to how on earth we can predict them reliably, if at all. But the animals seem to. And I had a friend here the other day who's a specialist in animal hearing. And he pointed out there are a lot of animals, like in Australia we have flying possums, and this is one of them, that can detect very, very tiny changes in atmospheric pressure. So to me, it's possible at least that might be the sign that we're looking for, but we really don't know. This is still the holy grail of seismology, trying to find a reliable sign for earthquakes. just that animals quite often seem to. I was in Sri Lanka just after the tsunami in, I think it was 2005. And then our driver pointed out that there were a lot of animals that the locals had noticed were leaving just the day before the tsunami hit, leaving the coastline. So I think animals most definitely can detect something, but we just do not know what it is.
And it doesn't appear as if they have any actual knowledge of what's happening. They just have this sense that they need to be out of that space.
They just need, yeah, there's something funny happening here and I'm out of here. incidentally, and this is a little bit off the topic, I know, but when we were in Sri Lanka, we found a big difference between the terrible catastrophe in Sri Lanka and when the tsunami hit Indian shores nearby. And it was a difference in the reaction of people, a very interesting cultural difference. Was in Sri Lanka, before a tsunami comes, the water recedes, right, at a beach, say. And when the water receded in Sri Lanka, these lovely Sri Lankan people all went running out to see what had happened. So, of course, they were well out when the tsunami came and they couldn't get away. Whereas in India, where we also have some very good friends, when the waves receded, the locals took one look and think there's something like some, other mammalian species, I suppose, took one look and said, goodness me, something funny is happening here. And instead of going out to investigate, they headed for the hills, which is why there were many fewer casualties in that area.
Talk about this. I mean, the interesting thing about what you're discussing is that sometimes, and you mentioned the importance of sharing whatever it is we detect that shows instability, either existing or imminent. People make different choices about whether to heed those early warnings or to ignore them.
I think that's right. But you have to also bear in mind that at this stage, these early warnings can be rather ambiguous. I mean, we talk about increasing oscillations between extreme states, for example. Now, if you look at the world's weather at the moment and world catastrophes, we're seeing a huge number of disasters around the world at the moment. And even here in my country, in the state of Queensland, we had floods just a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
That covered an area of Queensland which was the size of France and Germany combined. Which I think you're talking about Texas and a few of the adjacent states. One flood. that's huge. And there are some very extreme things happening. Now, they could be a sign, a warning that some big transition like global warming is coming. But we can't prove that. All we can do is keep our eyes open and put this together with all the other evidence. I mean, I think sometimes the warnings are there, but if you start getting more and more extreme arguments in a relationship, that's a fair old sign that the relationship's on the way to breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes these warning signs can be quite unambiguous. Sometimes they can be a bit ambiguous. But if we know what to look for, I think that's the point of this. From these ecological studies, if we know what to look for in the way of warning signs, then at least we've got to start. Now we've got to build on that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to Think. My guest this hour is science writer Len Fisher, whose new book is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities, How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. You write that regardless of whether a crisis is social or natural, it's critical to understand the effects of stress. And we sometimes conflate stress and strain in common speech, but those are very different things. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I can, but I don't want to be giving a physics lesson on your show, really.
That's all right.
But we can have it. We can certainly have a go. And when we talk about stress and strain in physics, we're talking about stress as being applied to something, whereas when we talk about it in relationships, we tend to talk about it as being a response, right? Like I'm being stressed.
Mm-hmm.
But stress in a physical sense is simply applying a stronger and stronger force to something so that it bends and maybe eventually breaks. Strain is the degree of bending.
The reception
so
of that force.
How far something bends is its strain. How what is pushing it to bend is the stress that you're applying. And there's a lovely and very simple relation. Now we're getting into the physics, and I'm going to get carried away here if I'm not careful.
That's all right.
But there's a very simple relationship which just says that for most flexible materials, stress divided by strain is a constant. It's called Young's modulus. Mm-hmm. There you are. That's the physical science. The real thing is that as you apply stress and as the body, as whatever it is, responds with greater and greater strain, there comes a point, a breaking strain, if you like. It can't deform any further without cracking. And when you get the runaway effects, well, I think I've got some examples in the book of where bridges have collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one particular case where workers were trying to actually fix up a bridge. So they had big concrete trucks on one end of this bridge. And that bridge was not designed to take the weight of big concrete trucks. And so when the last one basically rolled onto the bridge, something just underneath there had to give. So you got to the breaking strain and something gave. But of course, as soon as that particular crack started, what happened was that it ran along to the next point where there was a rivet, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also under the same stress then, so that broke. And you get this zipper effect, this runaway effect, where the crack starts in one place and just runs along, transmitting the stress as it does. And there was a wonderful example of this, although not maybe to the sailors, involved the SS Schenectady Liberty ship quite a few years ago that was just sitting peacefully in the dock minding its own business. And there'd been a crack down the side. And one of the things about cracks is right at the tip of the crack, all of the stress concentrates. And the sharper the crack, the greater the stress. For cracks of a certain... And there's a critical length. Once a crack gets to a critical length, then you can get a runaway effect. And in this particular case, the thing was just sitting peacefully in dock and had this crack in the side for ages. But the crack was perilously close to the runaway point.
Hmm.
And maybe there was a little wave, something like that, that just took it another couple of inches. When it did, it got to the runaway point, and people miles away heard this sudden bang as the ship spontaneously broke in half. And the crack ran all the way down.
Yeah, it's an amazing photograph you have in the book there.
Oh, yes, that's a beauty, isn't it?
And I was going to say, you've also given us an English lesson in that example of the bridge when the concrete trucks came to actually repair it. I think you defined irony for us better than anything I've ever heard.
Oh, you're very, very kind.
My guest is Len Fisher. Let's go on the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 to Augustine in Fort Worth. Hi, Augustine.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
I was going to make a comment about animal behavior. You know, I left Cancun on September 13, 1988, and that morning, before the Category 5 hurricane, you can sense the pressure dropping so bad around that it was very quiet. All the birds flew off, left immediately, all day long. It was that eerie feeling of something is leaving, you know. It was the hurricane sucking in all the pressure.
Hmm.
And I think if we pay more attention to animal behavior or really study more in depth what they perceive, we may be able to detect or prevent more of these disasters and take actions immediately once those things are detected. Because I think the main problem we have is skepticism. People don't think it's going to happen. And we get some signals. We sometimes even get some false alarms, you know. I was in Hawaii when we were expecting that that tsunami, and I went all the way up to the tallest place in Honolulu, and nothing really happened. But those things, even if it's a false alarm, is better than a tragedy. That's my comment about animal behavior.
Thank you so much for your call, and be careful on those vacations, Augustine. What do you think about that, Len?
I think he's got a very good point. But I think the main point from the point of view of scientists is that we still don't know quite what it is that animals are responding to. So while we have to use them as the detectors, we're never quite going to believe it. I mean, some people do, some people don't. If in this day and age we knew what it was that they were noticing, mm-hmm. And if we could measure it ourselves, we wouldn't really need the animals. But they'd be a very, very good first warning to say, hey, have a look, see if this is happening. And that would remove some of the ambiguity.
I guess the challenge there is that it's really hard to replicate those conditions in a controlled setting.
Oh, it is really difficult. As I say, the only example that I really know is people studying animal hearing and finding that animals are able to respond to incredibly tiny differences in pressure. Some animals much smaller than we're able to notice. So there's that. But it is difficult. There's no question it's difficult.
My guest this hour is science writer Len Fisher. His new book is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities, How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer Len Fisher. His new book is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities, How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. Len, we do have to consider when we think about maybe studying animals and how they might predict these things, there's also the cherry-picking phenomenon to be careful of, which is that maybe the animals ran out of the forest or away from the shoreline, you know, 12 weeks before something happened, and no one really noticed because no crisis followed.
Oh, well that's absolutely right. I think in this particular case, we're probably not cherry-picking. Animals do tend to notice unusual weather patterns, but whether they're actually predicting a disaster, a catastrophe, is another matter again. Yes, it is very easy to cherry-pick your data, and the physicist Niels Bohr said that prediction is very difficult, especially about the future.
Well, it happens even when people have the best of intentions. People don't necessarily mean to incorrectly manipulate data, but it can happen.
It absolutely can. Now, I'm trying to. You've probably got an example from the book that you have in mind and that I've forgotten that I wrote about, have you?
No, just the idea that, you know, it happens often, even, you know, when people used to believe that their dreams could predict things. You know, you have a bad dream and then you get in a car accident and you assume that dream predicted it, and you forget that you had bad dreams 11 nights before that.
That's true. You can fall for these. Well, they're pretty standard logical fallacies, and cherry picking is certainly one of them. You pick the data to fit your hypothesis, we say in science. And if you believe something, you look for cases that support it, and you tend to ignore the cases that don't support it. In terms of predicting what's going to happen in the future, it's very, very easy to do that, which is, as I say, we're just at the beginning of this in terms of looking for signs that the stock market is going to collapse, that your relationship's going to go haywire, or even that there's going to be some international catastrophe. People at the moment, myself included, are looking very hard at what's been happening in some of the Middle East countries.
Yeah.
And trying to understand, were the signs there dream states, flicking backwards and forwards between different states, a lack of resilience. Were these signs there that we could have picked up? Because I think you had your Secretary of State, Robert Gates, saying at West Point just earlier this year, then when it comes to predicting these situations, the U.S. military has a 100% record that it has never, ever gotten it right. How do you predict these things? And one of the things you can do is to look back and see where were the signs. Okay, now we look ahead and say, where are the signs now? Are there places, are there political systems, are there countries where these signs are showing that things could go haywire? The trouble is, in most countries, if you look, if you you can cherry pick. If you just look for the signs, you'll see them. Finding the ones that are significant is very difficult. I mean, my own opinion is you've got to factor in a lot of other things as well. Like if you have a country which is very, very dependent on food imports, then some of the United Nations reports are saying that these are the countries that are very susceptible, very vulnerable. If you're leaving yourself open to the action of other countries so much, then you are vulnerable. And if you look at that sort of thing together with the warning signs, maybe you've got some sort of a chance of saying, look, you know, here's somewhere that's under threat where maybe we can help. But it's not easy, and I would hate to pretend that, give facile answers and pretend that it's easy. It really is a matter of looking very carefully and thinking, okay, we've got one more clue here. Maybe we can use it.
And what do we do about Nassim Taleb's black swan effect? I think about a place like Tunisia, where there may have been signs that, made it evident that something like this was going to happen, but it was this really despondent fruit seller committing suicide that, started what appeared to be the whole thing.
Well, that's what, as Nassim says, black swans, which or outliers, if you like, sudden, unexpected events. These are the ones that do cause the dramatic changes in history. They are the ones that are hardest to predict. And I think I've given many examples from science where the whole advance of science is dependent on black swans.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite example is the discovery of X-rays. You can't just send somebody out there and say, please, could you find something that can let us see bones or bullets inside a body? It just wouldn't work. The black swan in this particular case happened because somebody was trying to work out how gases conduct electricity. And they noticed X-rays as a side issue. So, yes, black swans, these unusual critical tipping points, have been intrinsically unpredictable. The point about this latest work from ecology and applying it to other areas is that now at least we know in complex systems, complex social systems, where you've got this balance between a whole lot of processes, then we do have a chance of using these warning signs to predict there's a big change underway, even if we don't know what the change is going to be. When you get to simpler systems, like, for example, earthquakes, where you have a build-up of stress and then suddenly everything goes. Just because the system is simple means that you haven't got this complicated balance of processes, and it's not nearly so easy, if at all, to detect the same warning signs. They're probably just not there. They only come in complex societies, complex ecosystems, complex economies. But in the simpler systems, like the collapse of a bridge or the explosion of an earthquake or a volcano, where it's just a simple the build-up of stress until everything goes bang, then you probably can't use them and you're looking for other warning signs instead, just like the build-up of stress, knowing what's going on in the process. So they're not so easy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Fort Worth. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about a theory regarding earthquake prediction, and that is that it has the most severe ones have to do with the phase of the moon, which is when the new moon is between the Earth and the sun, it exacerbates the gravitational distortion of the Earth's crust and causes these large earthquakes. And the time period seems to be 2 days before to two days after that new moon. In fact, the Haitian earthquake, the Indonesian tsunami, and most recently the Japan earthquake are good examples. And what I'm wondering is if there's more research being done on that, or if this is just another example of, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics by a few people trying to prove a point.
What do you know about that, Len?
Very little, but the little that I do know suggests that it's probably cherry-picking. In other words, because you see a correlation between two things doesn't mean that there's a causal relationship between them. In fact, if you look at the forces involved, yes, the moon causes the tides, and yes, the tides lift a couple of feet, but it's rather unlikely in most cases to have been a critical factor. There are so many other factors which generate such higher forces that it's rather unlikely. As far as I can say, I'm afraid, it's certainly not one that's taken seriously in the seismology community.
1-800-933-5372, our number. Next on the line, we have Andrew in Dallas. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks.
I just had mainly one easily explainable question. Every year we see more floods, we see more tsunamis, you know. Here in Dallas-Fort Worth, we've had two earthquakes in the past 2 years. They were small, but we never had an earthquake in Dallas-Fort Worth before, from my knowledge. And, I mean, our world's changing around us every day, but I want to know, what's the worst and best-case scenario in this? I mean, even if we plan for it, even if we work together as a community of people, what are we supposed to do when this sets off? I hear worst-case scenarios of, you know, super volcanoes and pole shifts. Where should I put my faith, and what should I do if I feel like I can't change any of them?
Yeah, well, what about the things that we can predict, Len, but that we cannot prevent?
Well, yes. Super volcano is almost surely the worst. A super volcano is something that throws out at least 300 cubic kilometers of magma, which is one hell of a lot, much, much more than we've had in recorded human history. The last one, I think, was about 26,000 years ago. The next one is predicted to go sometime in the next 100,000 years, and it will, if it goes, affect the whole climate of the Earth. The last one's supposed to have killed off about 60% of humanity. The next one is most likely, as far as I know, to be Yellowstone Park. And at Yellowstone, which is a giant caldera, if that goes, that's going to be bigger than most of the ones that we know about. Now, what can we do about it? At the moment, not very much, except watch and wait and hope. But one of the hopes, of course, is over thousands of years that we'll develop ways to maybe release the pressure before it turns into a supervolcano. It's certainly something that we should be looking at much, much harder than probably we are so far. But maybe we're not so far because we just don't know what to do. What you're doing is waiting for a black swan. You're waiting for an advance in science and you don't know where it's going to come from. Mm. That will help us to resolve the problem, hopefully, before it comes. But yes, it's a very, very serious question. The other possibility, of course, is an asteroid strike. And we actually know, because NASA has been looking through the Space Guard program at asteroids, and we do know that the next one will hit on the 16th of March, 2880, and land in the Atlantic Ocean. There's only a probability of 0.33%, but even so, you'll find that people are thinking about how we can deflect such an asteroid before it gets here, and there's a number of interesting ways to do it. Thinking about asteroids is going on. I think maybe we should be thinking about a few things closer to home.
You know, another thing that becomes very clear as we have this conversation, Len, is the importance of not only different scientific disciplines working together, because if you have an asteroid striking the Earth, that involves biologists, that involves, astronomers and cosmologists, but also the idea that scientists need to work in concert with political systems and social organizations. Are we getting better at sort of forging those relationships?
Well, I think I can tell you that we're trying from the science side, but it's very hard going. I mean, one recent example is if when you look at banking crises have a lot to do with epidemics.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be a runaway affair. In an epidemic, one person can infect more than one other person who can infect more than one other person. And that, if you look at the physical process, is very like a nuclear explosion. You just get this runaway effect. But you can only get the runaway effect in the banks because they form such a tight network. And the obvious way to control that, which has been pointed out by some very prominent ecologists, writing with bankers working together, is to cut the links, is to actually have more independence among financial institutions, which... Then once you've got the independence, then if one financial institution goes, it's not going to take a whole lot down with it. But that's not going to happen. When you look at the meetings that happened after the banking crisis, you find that these people were talking about more capitalization, more control. They were not talking about cutting the links at all. In fact, they were talking about stronger links, which is just the wrong way to go.
Hmm. The last thing I want to ask you, we just have about 10 seconds left. Do you find regular people more interested in science now that you've focused your career on writing for a general audience?
Very, very much. People want to know about science. They want accessibility. And what I've been trying to do is to provide accessibility by showing how scientists think about the everyday problems of life, the big ones and the small ones. I hope it's working. I think we need it to.
The new book by Len Fisher is called Crashes, Crises, and Calamities, How We Can Use Science to Read the Early Warning Signs. Len, thanks again for being with us and for staying up all night. We really appreciate it.
Oh, look, I've really enjoyed this, and you've been a wonderful interviewer. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.